The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Yellowstone has the distinction of being the first U.S. national park, as signed into law by Ulysses S. Grant in 1872, but it was the White Mountains of New Hampshire that for decades prior came to capture the imagination of American tourists, symbolize the raw beauty of the American landscape, and influence a generation of American artists. A new exhibit at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, New Hampshire, explores how artists, scientists, and changes in technology help to influence our ideas of beauty and wilderness and transform the White Mountains into a center for early American tourism. The exhibit is called Mount Washington, the Crown of New England, and joining us to tell us more is Andrew Sparr, the Currier's Director of Collections and Exhibitions. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
So today, Washington, often called home of the world's worst weather, because of the famous wind speed measurement taken in, I think it was the 20s?
I don't remember exactly.
Because of the famous wind speed measurement. But it was a famous destination long before then. When did the White Mountains start to take hold of that American consciousness?
Well, our exhibition covers a period from the late 1820s to the 1880s, and it's during that period that Mount Washington goes from being basically an unexplored wilderness with few people living there to one of the most popular tourist attractions in the United States. And by the 1850s, it is well populated with tourist hotels and tourist attractions.
Including the Summit House and the Tip Top House.
By the early 1850s, yeah. There are two hotels built on the summit. Many people would stay overnight. The cost of an overnight stay was about $1.50, and you would get food and a heated room or room with a fire. You'd get dinner and a room. And by 1859, Thomas Starr King, who was one of the literary proponents of Mount Washington and the White Mountains, was already lamenting that there were more than 5,000 people a year going to the summit. And that would have been either on foot or by one of the several bridle paths that serviced the summit area. So by the late 1850s, it was already considered a crowded tourist location.
Yeah, so maybe one of the first places where you have that dual relationship between it's popular for a reason, and then once the crowds start to come in, you know, some folks just aren't as excited, maybe.
There's a long history of entrepreneurship in the White Mountains related to tourism. As early as 1819, the Crawford family began to construct the first path to the summit of Mount Washington and immediately began taking adventurous tourists to the summit.
So let's take us back to the 1820s. You've got all this beautiful artwork that's hanging up at the Currier. Now, where was the art world at this point? I think this is the Romantic period, if I've got that right.
The exhibition includes several of the most important paintings of Mount Washington from the late 1820s to the 1880s.
Yeah.
And by the late 1820s, Thomas Cole, an important artist from the New York area, who is one of the founding members of the Hudson, what we call now the Hudson River School, had traveled to New Hampshire and had done a series of images in both painting and print of Mount Washington. And these images were shown in New York and were then circulated as printed materials. And that really began the artistic interest in Mount Washington. A number of early artists came up between 1830 and 1850, but it was in 1851 when John Kensett produced his monumental picture of Mount Washington from the Valley of Conway that the art world really set up and took notice. Mm. The painting was exhibited in New York, and then it was reproduced in print. Over 13,000 copies were circulated around the art world in 1851. And immediately following that, by the summer of 1852, there were many artists traveling from New York and Boston and Philadelphia to come to North Conway to paint the meadows, to paint views of Mount Washington and the surrounding landscape.
So there's sort of a popularity there where, you know, one person made this landscape trendy, almost.
Indeed. And landscape painting really was not that important in the early 19th century. In part, it's the images of Mount Washington that really announced landscape painting as a viable artistic endeavor. Hmm. And Kensett's painting and a number of works that came afterwards by artists like Jasper Cropsey and Albert Bierstadt really helped establish the idea of landscape painting and American landscape painting as an important art form.
Now, one of the works featured in your exhibit, Albert Bierstadt's The Emerald Pool, which is a truly massive painting, I understand. I haven't gotten a chance to see it myself. Mount Washington looms in the distance of this painting. It almost seems exaggerated in size to me. There's such a... It has such a character as a mountain in these paintings.
It's a very interesting painting in that it's really quite theatrical. In 1870, Bierstadt had already been out west to Yosemite and to Yellowstone and came back to New Hampshire and decided to try to produce on the same large scale a dramatic image of the eastern landscape. And of course, he chose Mount Washington as the most iconic and symbolic location to work. He produced over 200 sketches on paper and painting in advance of producing the final work. Those were lost in a studio fire, so we don't know what they all looked like,
right,
leaving us with a bit of a mystery. But this was one of a series of large paintings by Bierstadt and other artists that were produced as theatrical events. These paintings would travel around the country. They would be shown in a gallery space. People would be charged to see them or to view them, sort of like a premiere of a movie. And it's also important to remember that these dramatically lit and painted canvases would have been shown in spaces that were either daylit by skylights or would have been lit by candlelight or gaslight because we didn't have electric light at that point.
Right.
So one of the ironies of Bierstadt's painting is there's a wonderfully detailed foreground view of the Emerald Pool surrounded by wonderfully delineated foliage, and in the background, Mount Washington looms above the Emerald Pool, but you cannot see Mount Washington from the Emerald Pool. So Bierstadt has concocted this theatrical drama for his viewers. The painting has not been seen in New England since 1870 when it was shown in Boston, after which it traveled to a number of cities in the United States, and then it was shown in Europe in London and also shown in Vienna at the International Exposition in 1873, where it won a medal. And one of the things we try to talk about in the exhibition is the interest on the part of European audiences, especially in London, in images of Mount Washington and of the New Hampshire landscape. So this landscape, our landscape of New Hampshire, really became a symbol of the American wilderness, but also a symbol of America's scenic beauty in the years before the Civil War on both sides of the Atlantic.
I'm speaking with Andrew Sparr. He's director of collections and exhibitions at the Currier Museum of Art. Their new exhibition is Mount Washington, the Crown of New England. It's an exploration of some of the artwork that contributed to the White Mountains' development as a symbol of the American landscape and as a tourist destination. I was sort of shocked when I was learning about the history of White Mountain tourism that even back then there was this sort of early example of tragedy tourism. This was the Wiley family?
The Wiley family tragedy, yeah. Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, some writers have referred to it as disaster tourism. It was popular in the Romantic era, especially in the first half of the 19th century. The Wiley family lived in Crawford Notch, and in the summer of 1826, there was a tremendous landslide that coursed down the mountain. And the family was buried along with two hired hands in the landslide. Ironically, their house, which they had fled during the landslide, was left untouched. And this irony was not missed by writers and by tourists. And immediately following this disaster, it was recorded on both continents in newspapers, and the Wiley site till this day remains a popular tourist attraction in the White Mountains. The dangers of Mount Washington itself were widely reported in the press, and with the first death of the first death on the mountain of Dr. Strickland in 1849, followed by the well-publicized death of Lizzie Borne in 1855, which was even celebrated in the New York Times 50 years later. And then the published account of Dr. Ball's 3 days trying to survive a fall blizzard on Mount Washington with just a raincoat and an umbrella. The whole idea of the danger of Mount Washington and the attraction of the weather as a tourist vehicle in itself became very popular. So the hotels themselves would publish, the summit hotels would publish accounts of weather readings as well as summer snowstorms to try to help to attract tourists, especially from the urban center in New York and around Boston. So you'll find in the New York Times in the 19th century accounts written by tourists of snowball fights that they had on the summit in July or August, or trips to the Snow Arch in Tuckerman's Ravine, which was still in late July and August in the 19th century, the Snow Arch was still intact in the ravine.
And it was that extreme weather that I understand is part of the attraction for scientists, and especially meteorology, which was I think early on, probably a fairly new science.
Indeed it was. You know, one of the things that really interested me as I studied this more and learned through our collaboration with the Mount Washington Observatory and their curator there, Peter Crane, was how important Mount Washington was to scientists in the 19th century. As early as the 1820s, botanists are coming to study the unique plant life above treeline. By the 1840s, there's interest on the part of scientists from Europe, so it becomes an international destination for scientific study because of this unique plant life, but also the fact that the geology is very evident and apparent above treeline, and that gave people an opportunity to study the rocks. There is a lot of interest at this point in glaciers and how glaciers were formed, and Mount Washington became an early site for the development of theories on glaciation. Scientists were also looking for evidence of the biblical flood and thought that, for instance, deposits like glacial boulders were visible evidence of the Great Flood. So this idea that scientists were very interested in Mount Washington really combines with the work of artists, because many scientists hired artists and photographers to illustrate their publications. At the same time, artists in the 19th century were very interested and well-read in scientific theories and did their best to depict whether it was botanical specimens or geology as accurately as possible. In fact, it was said that Asherby Durand was so accurate in his depiction of rock formations such as those of Cathedral Ledge and Whitehorse Ledge that a trained geologist could look at his painting and identify the rock types from the painting itself because they were done in such accurate detail.
Oh, that's impressive. There's so many things to wonder about when it comes to the mountain and so many beautiful things to see in this exhibition. That being said, you know, we do have Yellowstone and Yosemite and some of the great other national parks now. And I wonder, to you, has that changed the legacy of the White Mountains? And what do you think that is going forward?
If we look at the paintings of Mount Washington and the White Mountains, by the end of the 1870s and into the 1880s, the art world really begins to move on. Landscape painting becomes less about an accurate depiction of the geography and geology in front of us, and it becomes more about exploring effects of light and atmosphere. So we think of the rising Impressionists. Homer is painting on Mount Washington the same year that Monet is doing his earliest Impressionist paintings.
Oh, wow.
So this interest in light and atmosphere can really be explored almost anywhere, whether that's in your garden, whether it's on Long Island. So the idea of having to travel to an exotic place like the White Mountains to capture landscape becomes less an important part of the artistic dialogue or artistic narrative of the late 19th century. Also, following the Civil War, as the Western landscape opens up, at that point, artists like Bierstadt become more interested in painting that dramatic scenery, whether it's Bryce Canyon or the Grand Canyon or Yosemite or Yellowstone National Park. I think what we see in the White Mountains and Mount Washington is an enduring tradition on the part of artists in painting that landscape. So there are many artists that work well into the 20th century, including a number of modernist artists such as Marsden Hartley, who traveled to New Hampshire to paint Mount Washington and the White Mountains. And I think in part this is carrying on this tradition of its importance to 19th century painters, but also an opportunity for these modernist artists to grapple with an iconic subject from American art history in a new and different way. And then, of course, today we have artists that are very interested in painting the landscape of the White Mountains and are actively working in the area and are exhibiting in many of our local galleries and institutions.
Well, the tradition continues, and thank you so much for speaking with me, Andrew.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
Andrew Sparr is Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Currier Museum of Art. Their new exhibition is Mount Washington, the Crown of New England. There's a catalog of the same name, and the exhibition includes paintings, photography, postcards, and guidebooks, really an extensive amount of material, and some fantastically amazing and beautiful stuff. You can learn more at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. When it comes to music, Americans have a bit of a love affair with the offbeat, the musical misfits, those out-of-tune vocalists that manage to captivate audiences despite having less than perfect technique or tone. But it's more complicated than that, because sometimes we love to love bad singing, sometimes we love to hate it, and sometimes bad singing transcends its badness and somehow becomes good. Carl Wilson is music critic for Slate, where he recently wrote about this very subject. It's a sort of meditation on our cultural attraction and repulsion to bad singing. And he joins us now to talk about it with me. Carl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So Obviously, there's a lot of different ideas about what bad singing is and maybe how we react to it as a society. And off the bat, one of my first thoughts is that it's clear that this has a lot to do with context, right?
Absolutely. You know, music in general is always contextual, and there's different traditions and different genres, and what's considered good and bad in each is really kind of fixed by its history and by its audience. And so whenever we talk about bad singing, there's really no sort of objective thing that you can point to as bad singing in all kinds of circumstances. All kinds of styles and all kinds of things can work in the right place. You know, it's the same way that you might, on the one hand, have a rough kind of rustic singer like Hank Williams, and you can't easily put that up alongside an operatic diva and talk about good singing and bad singing as though that's the same thing in each of those contexts.
Right. Although I will say, of all the different clips that you put in your article, there are some that are closer to being what we might call objectively bad, even if that doesn't exist. I want to play a clip. This is Ice JJ Fish. His song On the Floor has over 50 million views on YouTube, so still popular. Let's listen to a little bit.
It's something about the girl that just makes my head wanna twirl. Oh, you got me want to tell all them other girls. There's nothing else better on this world. The moment I seen her, I was in shock. So shocked you wouldn't think
so. Oh, man, when that harmony comes in, that's tough.
Yeah, that's kind of the special moment. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that guy's real name is Daniel McLeod. He's from San Antonio, Texas, and he just started posting songs on YouTube the way that people do nowadays. And YouTube has really become kind of this amazing forum for all kinds of music making, including this kind of modern version of the tradition of bad singing. And I think one of the things that fascinates people about somebody like him is this question of, like, what he perceives himself to be doing. Like, does he think that he's just singing great R&B there?
Right.
Or does he understand there's something comical about it? And if you look at internet forums, people argue about whether it's an act, whether he's joking, and all of these things at great length and have been for years now. And that's something you see throughout the history of these kind of novelty bad singing acts.
Yeah, I was thinking that same thing. Awareness of, you know, your voice seems to be such a big part of it, because if you're unaware, then there's something maybe charming about the authenticity. But if you know it's a joke, then if you're playing it really well, it's almost impressive how well you're faking us all.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's also just, it's hard to tear yourself away from that uncertainty, that feeling of not knowing what you're seeing, not knowing what you're hearing. And that's kind of mesmerizing in itself.
Yeah, you bring up this kind of concerning point, though, and I hadn't thought too much about it, but you know, somebody like Ice JJ Fish or singing sensations like William Hung from American Idol. He famously did a really, you know, pretty painful rendition of She Bangs in front of the judges at the beginning of the show. You know, it seems like a lot of these people, they're from other cultures, they're people of color, and there's this feeling that maybe this is not in good spirits.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, on the one hand, there's that feeling of authenticity and sincerity that you think maybe there's an appreciation of some kind of universal humanity that goes on when we laugh or and enjoy this kind of performance. And then on the other side, there's kind of a frightening kind of freak show element to it. And it's really true that, you know, going back to the days of P.T. Barnum, there have been these kinds of freak act things in the history of American culture. And that's something that we have to be self-conscious about. And, it, you know, it's not a coincidence that a lot of these things that become sensations on YouTube or through American Idol are people who are racialized and who are not, you know, white straight men, just sort of standing out as representations of the dominant culture. And that's something that I think we need to be self-conscious about.
Well, I want to play another clip of something that we might call bad singing and talk about how, again, context plays a big role in how we look at this piece of music. This is Yoko Ono, and she's performing, I think, at a gallery, and it is a cover of a Katy Perry song. You may or may not be able to tell what it is.
Oh.
Okay, so if you couldn't tell, that was a cover of, I think, Firework.
Is that sounds like song? It was Fireworks.
Yeah, Fireworks by Katy Perry, the being performed by Yoko Ono. But this is such a good example because you might hear that and be like, oh, what terrible singing. But of course, she's not trying to be a good singer in this moment. This makes much more sense if you put it into the context of something like performance art, in which there's a different set of rules, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about the reputation of Yoko Ono, you know, because she actually came out of this very sort of high art tradition, and at a time in the 60s when she was affiliated with people like John Cage and his circle, where there was a lot of musical experimentation going on, and this sort of, this group called Fluxus that she was involved with did a lot of just sort of trying to take the materials of everyday life and make them strange, and her performance style was kind of evolved in that way, and with influences as well from traditional Asian music, and there's sort of a feminist statement in it and all of that. And then she hooks up with John Lennon, and suddenly new audiences are looking at her in the context of the Beatles, which, you know, really has nothing to do with the kind of thing that she did. And if people are listening to her sing and want it to sound like Love Me Do, then it sounds like pretty terrible singing. But that's really not what's going on at all. She's really an important pioneer of sort of vocal experimentation, especially for women in the history of new music.
I'm speaking to Carl Wilson, Slate's music critic, and we're talking about bad singing, why so many of us love it or love to hate it or just feel something about it, and we're not sure exactly what that is. One of the reasons that you wrote this article, I think, is because Florence Foster Jenkins, a singer, is getting her moment in the spotlight again with a new biopic starring Hugh Grant and Meryl Streep playing Jenkins. Can you give us a quick background on how does her story relate to this subject?
Yeah, well, Florence Foster Jenkins is kind of a classic case of, you know, these things we've been talking about, the sort of mystery of the bad singer and their intentions. She was a New York socialite in the first half of the 20th century, and a really important contributor financially and socially to supporting music in New York in that time. And she would sort of hold events to raise money for the opera and for the symphony and all that kind of thing, that kind of normal charitable work. But she, throughout her life, always had ambitions to be a musician herself. And she gave these recitals regularly where she would sing for her social peers. And she sang opera repertoire that was way beyond her ability. Her delusions kind of got grander and grander, and she eventually rented out Carnegie Hall and held a public recital to which all of New York could come, sold out the place, still one of the most sort of storied Carnegie Hall concerts ever. And it's really unclear whether she was just overambitious and just singing beyond her range, or whether she had some kind of perceptual disorder.
Yeah, so there we go. It is funny. It makes me think of how the venue and the place, it has so much to do with how we perceive these things. Because, you know, if you've got a friend who has a decent voice, you might be like, oh, my friend's got a great voice. But if you put them on a big stage and you expect them to stand side by side with performers that are of incredible technical skill, you know, you might be aghast at that same person who you previously praised.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. One of the things about singing is, you know, that we all can do it, or most of us do it, but nobody really knows how they sound, right? Because your voice resonates differently inside your body and inside your head than it does out in the world. And so, you know, all of the great singing that we think we do in the shower probably sounds kind of more like Florence Foster Jenkins when you had to get up on stage in Carnegie Hall. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes her story kind of human on that level. And again, there's that double-sidedness, because on the other hand, here's this rich lady whose friends all kind of conspired to sustain this delusion that she had, partly because it kept her enthusiastic about doing her charitable work and giving money to the real musicians of New York. And so, you know, and on one hand, it's this sort of touching sincerity, and on the other hand, it's this kind of disturbing illusion. And it's hard to know where to stand there.
Sure. Well, I was thinking, again, we talked about authenticity, but there's that one piece that you brought up at the end of your article. It's from a movie I haven't seen called Young at Heart, but it's such a perfect example of somebody who is not what we would call technically gifted, but whose voice resonates with such an emotional realness that it seems so much more powerful than somebody who's got, you know, the pipes, the runs, all that stuff. Let's listen to a little bit. This is an older gentleman. He's on stage. He's actually covering a song by Coldplay. And this is from the documentary Young at Heart.
Lights will guide you home, and in night your bones, and I will try to fix you.
I mean, this video is pretty amazing to watch. Can you describe a little bit what we're seeing or what we're listening to?
Yeah, yeah. You can't sort of get the full effects without the visual side of it. This man is wheelchair bound and breathing with an oxygen tank in his nostrils. And throughout the song, you actually hear the little pulse of the oxygen tank as it goes along. And he's singing. He's fronting this choir called Young at Heart from Massachusetts. Which has a sort of median age of about 83. And it's been going for decades now, and kind of led by this charismatic choir leader, they've sort of stepped away from the old-timey song repertory of a normal seniors choir and started singing rock songs and punk rock songs even, and just trying to sort of challenge the expectations of what old people can do. And, you know, that man actually has a lovely voice, but it's not a polished professional voice. And some of the singers in the choir are less polished than that. But it's really becomes just the celebration of what music means to us as human beings and the kind of deep depth of emotion that it can convey, and the technical things all kind of fall away. And I think that's one of the things that looking at this field of bad singing, so-called, reminds us, is that in some ways there's just something deep and kind of unspeakable about what music can do, and concerns about good and bad in many ways on that level can get in the way of, you know, something that we often lost touch with, which is the pleasure of just coming together as people, as families, as communities, and making music without concern for performance in the music industry and all of those questions.
Well, Carl, it's a really fascinating subject, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Carl Wilson is music critic for Slate. There's a link to read his article, Why Do We Love Bad Singing? And that's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. When the Library of Congress was established in the year 1800, it was mainly for legislative use, a repository of books that might help lawmakers forge their new nation. 200 years later, it's most familiar to public radio listeners as the place where we store all of those StoryCorps interviews.
It will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress.
Now, obviously, storing the world's knowledge involves a lot more than just the printed word these days, and that's why, since the 1990s, the Library of Congress has made various attempts to go digital. And yet, it has been tech companies that have emerged as the archivists of the internet age. Which begs the question, when so much information is stored in servers, does the Library of Congress still have a purpose? Kyle Chayka has written for The Verge, The New York Times Magazine, Billboard, and more. His recent article, The Library of Last Resort, appeared in N+1. And Kyle, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Before we talk about the Library of Congress and its attempts to digitize over the years, let's first establish just the scope of their operations. I guess I never really knew too much about what the Library of Congress actually does and what it looks like.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So I think what most people think of when they hear the Library of Congress, they think of, you know, the huge building in D.C. that's very grand, and that's called the Thomas Jefferson Building. But really what the Library of Congress is this huge network of storage facilities and other office buildings and, you know, data backup facilities that most people never get to see. And so when the Library of Congress collect something, and they have over 160 million objects in their collection, it doesn't just get put into a library somewhere. It could get digitized. It could get stored in a storage facility in Maryland. It just kind of goes through this huge process.
How do they decide what deserves to get saved, either digitally or otherwise. You talk about 160 million objects. It's just hard to imagine what collection looks like at this point. It sounds like they just save everything.
They kind of do save everything. The library's mission, I mean, even since it was founded, was kind of to provide anything that the government might need to refer to in the creation of laws. So if you think about that as a standard, almost all kinds of information fall under that rubric. And this guy, Spofford, who was one of the later librarians of Congress, he kind of decided that the U.S. government could use any and all information under the sun, really, to help its legislature. So from then on, the Library of Congress kind of started collecting just about anything. And Spofford was the Librarian of Congress from 1864 to 1897.
So in that case, what efforts has the Library of Congress made at digitization thus far, these past, say, 20, 25 years? And what exactly does that mean? I'm thinking scanning books, articles, putting it online?
Yeah, so digitization really means taking a physical object and scanning it or taking super high resolution photos of it and then uploading that onto the internet. And so the Library of Congress has digitized quite a bit and it started digitizing in 1990. But when you think about 160 million objects, you're never really going to get to scan all of them.
Yeah, especially I can't imagine what the rate of scanning versus the fact that if they're still collecting new objects, you know, it's almost an impossible task.
Yeah, they collect 10,000 new things every single day. So it's pretty much impossible to digitize everything. But they do have a committee that decides priorities for which things to digitize first. And that tends to be very visual collections that are in the public interest, like early American photos from the Great Depression or artifacts from the Civil Rights Movement. And objects like that get scanned and put up online. But you still have this vast collection that really is inaccessible to the public right now.
Well, and you point out that there really has been a failure, maybe in terms of cooperation, maybe in terms of budget to make strong efforts to digitize the collection. What would you say are the biggest impediments organizationally facing this effort?
I think organizationally, one of the problems is that the Library of Congress over the past 20 years or so hasn't cooperated with any outside institutions as far as digitization. So there were some early inroads that with Google, actually, that the Library of Congress was going to work with Google to digitize their collection. But that effort fell through, and the Library of Congress didn't want to cooperate with some other smaller initiatives that have started up, like the National Digital Public Library. And so the Librarian of Congress over the past few decades just kind of ignored these different collaborations that were possible and tried to bring all the digitization in-house and just focus on the institution itself. And I think that's a real problem in the internet age when we're all kind of collaborating on stuff.
Yeah, this is James Billington, who is head librarian from 1987 until 2015. You point out that there was this one effort, maybe a public perception coup, where they talked about preserving tweets. But even that, you write, really didn't hit the mark.
Yeah, so they announced that they were going to be archiving all of Twitter. And that was a big deal because it seemed very technologically advanced and it was super relevant. But as we've seen over the past few years since they made that announcement, there really hasn't been anything else. So they haven't created a searchable archive. They haven't made any kind of public interface for the Twitter archive. So I know staff there are pretty frustrated with that, and I think the American public is as well.
I'm speaking with writer Kyle Chayka. He wrote about how the Library of Congress has really struggled to evolve in the digital age over the past 25 years or so. I was really shocked by some of the quotes in your story where you spoke with a lot of employees at the Library of Congress, and they seemed so lost in this almost existential way. And I wonder, having now reported this, what do you think needs to happen moving forward to give the people at the Library of Congress a sense of purpose for what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one big step that did happen is that James Billington stepped down in 2015. And I know he was kind of the face of this problem that the library was having. And Obama nominated this woman named Carla Hayden, who worked in the Baltimore Public Library system, as the new Librarian of Congress. And she actually was confirmed fairly easily, despite all the government gridlock going on. And I think she's already really energized people and provided the library with a public face that's more technologically savvy and progressive.
It's funny, as I was reading this, you know, you can see the prerogative, the need to move towards a digital age. This is a library. Of course, libraries all around the country are trying to rethink their purpose within communities. At the same time, there's this part of me that has this really romantic notion about a physical library just full of millions and millions of books. And there was this thought that in some sort of terrible post-apocalyptic scenario where the internet is taken offline somehow, that, you know, the Library of Congress still ends up having this really, you know, strong reason for being.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean to argue that the Library of Congress doesn't have a purpose. I just think its purpose is kind of misunderstood. So its ultimate purpose is definitely to create this very permanent archive of material that matters to the United States. And like you said, if the internet were to go down, or if Google were to have a problem or disappear over the next century, the Library of Congress is still going to be there. And there are still going to be these warehouses full of books and important manuscripts, you know, underground in Washington, D.C. And I think we're going to be pretty thankful for that if anything so disastrous ever happens.
Well, Kyle Chayka, thank you so much for teaching me, anyway, a little bit about the Library of Congress.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Kyle Chayka wrote about the Library of Congress for N Plus One magazine, and you'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for tuning in today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and Jason Leonard. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. And you can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes as well. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.